First of all, thank you so much for coming. I'm glad the weather permitted this to take place today. We are very, very, very excited to have the Caring Pathways team here to talk about the importance of end-of-life care and to possibly turn some people in this room onto the idea of pursuing this as a career. So this is just sort of an opportunity to learn more about end-of-life care and to really also hear from several veterinarians who have chosen this as a career path. Dr. Magnuson is the founder and owner of Caring Pathways. He's had a long and diverse career, as has Dr. Lori. She used to work in ER medicine before coming to...
No, I was large animal.
Oh, large animal. Wow. Okay. Even better. And then Dr. Hahn found her path to end-of-life care straight out of vet school. So I think it's a pretty cool opportunity to hear their different perspectives on how they came around to hospice. And then Kim is the office manager of Caring Pathways. She manages their client relations team. So I think we really just want this to be interactive and just for you guys to ask questions, be curious, and learn more. And so, yeah, just please feel free to ask questions. And thanks for being here. Okay.
First of all, it's an honor and a privilege for us to be here with you all. Caring Pathways was birthed on December 14th, 2009. As Mavi has said, I graduated here from CSU in 1967, so I've been around quite a while. Practiced on the East Coast for 3 years in a very intense practice with great training. Came back and bought a practice in Denver. Sold it in 83. Went and taught high school chemistry for a year. And then came back to veterinary medicine, came up here and started Raintree Animal Hospital just west of here. And was there for 22 years. I like challenges. I love doing new things. I love looking at the future, as my team will testify to. And so I want to talk about Caring Pathways and the end-of-life care situation that we're in. How many of you are first-year students? Good. How many are second-year students? That's great. Third-year students? And fourth-year students. Good. what we'd like to do tonight is present to you what we are and then challenge you to think in terms of end-of-life care. I want to tell a couple of stories. I'm really into dialogue. This isn't a lecture from us. I sat where you are in vet school here in the 60s. Lectures are great, but dialogues and the ability to come to some kind of consensus of what's going on is really, really important. And it's important to me, and it's important to my team. How many of you are here tonight, and you've already decided that end-of-life care may be something you really want to do? Okay. How many of you have thought about it and are kind of exploring it as a real good possibility? How many of you have come tonight just as a matter of curiosity? Good. There's some things that we want to cover today, and it's the history and development of Caring Pathways as who we are today, starting in 2009, beginning to develop the thought, actually moving back to Denver. I was awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning on December 14th, 2009. I am a believer in Christ, but I won't say that that's the only reason I got this. But it was one of those things where I knew Kathy Cooney because I ran Raintree. She was doing end-of-life care for pets. I had looked at it and thought, well, that's kind of unique, but I can't see how you can make a business out of it. And as my team will testify, I'm a business man. I love running businesses, I love creating businesses, and I love the profit from business. And profit is not a bad word. And so when I looked at it, I thought, there's no way you can make a business out of this. If you go back 12 to 15 years ago, no one was talking about end-of-life care or hospice palliative situations in human medicine. I mean, in veterinary medicine. And I want to tell you a little story. I was in school here in the 60s. I worked at Poudre Valley Hospital as an orderly on a 3 to 11 shift through my undergraduate work and through vet school. My junior and senior year, I transferred from there over to South Aventide to work in a nursing home because I had more time to study. And what I saw in human medicine is the same exact thing that's now happening in veterinary medicine. In the 60s, when a person became into that end-of-life care situation, there weren't a lot of people to take care of. And in fact, I witnessed this. They were sent to nursing homes basically to die. The care was given as a secondary thing. You didn't have MDs who went and specialized in end-of-life care. You didn't have nurses who specialized in end-of-life care. The hospice palliative care movement in human medicine did not really begin until the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. And now you see what has happened in human medicine. And I'm here to tell you that within 15 to 20 years, this will be not just a thing that we get involved in. It will be something that you will be challenged in veterinary school as a specialty. Now, you may look at that and say, I don't know. You will, because I watched in human medicine. And if you go back even 10 years ago, you weren't seeing anything in the journals about hospice palliative care. You were not going to meetings and hearing people talk about end-of-life care. And now the AHA, although they're not doing this much now because they're now in the business stuff, but you can't hardly go to any meeting now that does not have a track on end-of-life care. So I'm just challenging you to think hard about that as a possibility. What we want to cover today is the history and development of caring pathways. Why is it important in today's environment to really look at this? The whys, whats, and hows of end-of-life care services in the home. I really believe that, and so does the team, when we're talking about this end-of-life care, the home setting is so much more important to the client and to the pet. I didn't believe this when I had Raintree, although I did some in-home euthanasias. But once we started this and I began to see this incredible bond that you make with clients, as this team will attest to, we allow for an hour in the home, sometimes as long as an hour and a half. And what you will find is you will create a bond with people in this most difficult time in their pet's life and their situation that is basically remarkable. And I didn't believe this until I started doing it. We get more letters back and comments about what they liked about us in a week than I got in 3 months in my practice, because people so appreciate your taking the time to enter into their grief. Caring Pathways is a business. We have now 21 people on our team. We have a grief specialist. We have a person who is a marketeer and does development in the practice. Josh, my grandson, does all of our social media. And just to give you a little perspective, this is our 9th year doing this in the Denver metro area. Businesses grow, and then they have a tendency to level off and grow like this. We are still growing at 30% a month over last year. And we're now in our 9th year. So the demand for this business is huge. I give this picture, and this is a picture that I received early on in this. I love to study. I'm a Colorado native. I was born here, raised in a farm and ranch community in eastern Colorado. And I love the history of the mining towns. And they were always looking for the mother lode. They might work in the creek. They might find a little creek and start mining. But what we're doing at Caring Pathways, we started just sifting sand, looking for some gold nuggets. But there is a mother lode. We haven't reached it yet. In fact, I've done a lot of studies and statistics. Our growth has been phenomenal in the last 9 years. We have 10 veterans on the team, plus the other team members, client relations team. And we need 2 more veterinarians right now. We've actually hired a company out of Albuquerque, starting to look for veterinarians, because many of you have not been exposed yet to the dynamic, incredible things that this part of the profession gives us. I think Angel may talk about some of this, and I could tell you some other stories. In fact, I'll tell you one. I was at the AHA meeting in Austin, Texas, several years ago, and I had messed around and hadn't gotten my registration, so I wasn't in the host hotel. I was about, a half a mile away from the host hotel, which is because I like to walk. So I got early one morning, was just walking to the convention. As I was walking along, there were 2 gentlemen who had a badge on, and so I asked them, I said, "Where are you guys from?" They said, "Upper New York State." And they were both in their 60s. And so we started talking, and I asked them a little bit about their practice. And they turned to me and said, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, we have an end-of-life care service for pets in the home." And, I mean, literally, we're just walking. They stopped, looked at me, and said, "Is that all you do?" That's the response that you will get still in this part of where we are. And I'm here to tell you, yes, that's all we do. And it's by reason. It's by a strategic, intentional plan, because I know that these people that we serve, people that you can serve, are people who want that. I mean, we have so many people in Oregon, Angel can attest to this, who just are so thankful you came to the home and helped. So we can do a lot of, well, not lecture. I don't want a lecture. I want this to be a dialogue. I really do. And so what I'd really like for you to do is, let's just open this up and have questions, because we're here to serve you. Yes, we have stories. We have things we can talk about. Got other things I can talk about, but I'd really like to see, what is it you want to know? Because we're really passionate about this. This isn't just a kind of ugly stepchild. This is really a viable, incredible part of veterinary medicine. And like I say, you wait 10 to 15, 20 years, and you will be amazed at what you're going to see in our. Yes, ma'am.
What do you use to determine if a patient would be a good candidate for hospice care?
So, we use a tool, quality of life scale, which I fall back on time and again, as well, to really help make that determination of whether that patient is an acceptable candidate from a humane standpoint. You know, can the owners provide the level of care that that animal really needs? Or is that animal one that they cannot be maintained in the home as far as pain, probably primarily, and nausea and vomiting, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that quality of life scale we rely on every day.
Yes, I want to make one comment. And in that, it's also assessing the pet while you're there, because there's so many dynamics that go on in this time you have with this client. There are times when they really don't know how far gone this pet is. And that's part of the stuff of us educating. One of the things that we talk about is this is as close to emergency medicine as you're going to have in a different vein. It's crisis medicine. And Kim can talk about that in regards to the phone calls and stuff. Our client relations team, there's six members of the client relations team, the things that they deal with in phone calls and stuff, you know, they're not calling to make an appointment 3 weeks from now. They're calling because all of a sudden they're in a crisis, and that's part of our teaching and training over the years of what they begin to need to look at. Because most people, we're in an anti-death culture. And so people don't want to even talk about it or even think about it. And so oftentimes the question of hospice palliative care as versus euthanasia becomes something that has to be dealt with right there in the home at the time. You know what Lori is talking about. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering like how you integrate like referral veterinarians or time.
When we moved to Denver, I created a letter, quite extensive letter, that we sent out to all the veterinarians in the Denver metro area. Just explaining what we're doing. We're not competing against your practices. We're here to help you because we know that this is a viable situation. Now, I'm persistent, okay? We got a lot of negative feedback. Who do you think you are? Why are you doing this? We sent the letter again. And I revised the letter. And over a period of, I had practiced in Denver for quite a while before I came to Fort Collins. And so I went around and talked to veterinarians that I knew. And we started getting referrals, but not many. But we, with their website and the stuff we were doing, we got people calling. Well, they would go back to their animal hospitals and say, oh my gosh, this was such a great experience. And they would call, and I would go talk to them. And we started getting some referrals, and then we hired Roger Van Orden. It was 4 years ago, in June or July, 4 years ago. And he's come on basically to do that. He's visited all the hospitals. And now about 38 to 40% of our business comes from referrals from practices in the area. And that continues to be. And so they see the value. And I'd like to get to 60%, but you know, that's time.
I think what does it is, you know, there's constantly communication with these vets. So if we go out and we help one of their clients, we're giving them a call, we're sending them a letter, so we're always in communication. We get a lot of positive, you know, feedback from them almost every time we call. You know, thank you guys so much for being able to serve our clients. Because it's such a niche that we're in and we're coming to the home, we're not really taking clients from them because they're not doing it in home anyway. This is something, you know, they want to help their clients through the, you know, the puppy stages and those times and sort towards the end of life. But, you know, we hear a lot that most of the veterinarians prefer not to do the euthanasias.
Yep.
So this is kind of a burden that we kind of take from them, which is an honor for us to be able to help. And I know when it comes to the hospice, at that point, they're kind of done going to the vet. The vet and them have already determined that. And still, there's still communication. So I think because there's such an open communication with all of the veterinary clinics we work with, it's a really good team that we kind of, you know, Because reality is, if they're referring to me and I have a client that's looking for a vet clinic, well, what area are you in? Okay, well, I don't know much about this vet clinic, but I know that they do refer to us often. Here's their phone number, that type of thing. So we just have a really good relationship with them because of communication.
For our hospice patients, there are those who don't have a relationship with a primary care veterinarian. And then there are those who, like Kim said, they no longer wish to go in for diagnostics or monitoring. But then we also have quite a few who they do still have their relationship with their primary care vet. And we foster that. We want them to maintain that relationship. So that communication is key. We also are sending them back, just in a way, for medications often. We actually do not stock medications for our hospice patients. We are asking their primary care vets to dispense to their patients, you know, at our request. So there's conversations in that regard. We also do, we try to utilize human meds, human pharmacies. But also, we are not getting in between them and their primary care vet. We have many hospice patients, hospice clients who, they've got one foot with us, one foot still with their clinic, and they will go back and forth, and we all are communicating with each other.
Ask me that too. So before vet school, I was in California, and I was a receptionist. One of the biggest reasons for why I really wanted to do this was they say, Angel, go to that room and kick them out. I'm like, they just euthanized their pet. And it's a grown man on the floor with his really beautiful Pyrenees that I've seen every single day. There was like about a month's worth of time where almost every day we had euthanasia. One day we had 7. That's never happened for that clinic before. The staff was so unhappy. The doctor has seen a lot of puppies into adulthood, and so I saw that it affected the entire practice. With that clinic, they didn't like home euthanasia type of services, so I didn't really think about that much at the time. But now I feel like there's a big change because I'll call veterinarians and say, hey, I went to see this person on creature, and this is what I would like to do. I want to see what you would like, or what did you guys talk about? And everyone's been very open, very willing to work together. A lot of times they're kind of frustrated because maybe it's a really big dog and it's hard for them to bring the dog into the clinic every single time. So I've seen that the communication has been very effective. So there was this family, I walk in, and there's mom, dad, and their daughter. Go through the whole spiel with them, and they're like, okay. Now we're going to go talk to the owner. I'm like, you guys aren't the owner? I'm like, no. It's my daughter, and she has Down syndrome. I'm like, oh, okay. I don't have training with that. And it's this little cute corgi named Mickey. So she comes down, and they're like, yeah, and you have to tell her that it's time. I'm like, okay. I'm just debating how I'm going to do this. It actually went really well. We talked about how Mickey was feeling, that it was really, really hard for them to eat. It probably didn't feel very good. And then I asked, like, what did she see with Mickey? And she saw some things. And it was hard at first because I would use big words or bigger words than normal. And then I realized she didn't understand. But eventually, she got it. And then as we were euthanizing, she tells me she cries a lot. And when she cries, her dog, Mickey, licks her tears. Guess what happened while we were euthanizing? And she's like this right in front of her puppy, but not a puppy anymore. And he's just licking her tears away. And it was actually really good for her in terms of, she's like, I want another Mickey. And I think it's like with Down syndrome, she may not understand certain parts of it. The family is very appreciative. It does get to you sometimes, but we do have a good team. And I think that is one of the main things. When I'm sad or things that really affect me, I call Lori, or my person is Dr. Carrie. She's not here with us today. And they listen.
I think one of the other things probably in that, and we've talked about this because of burnout and all the stuff we're now talking about,
It's my cue to talk to
you. If you can't hear me back there, just raise your hand.
Yeah.
I've been accused that my voice is too soft, so I will try to project. This is not a profession that's for everyone. Having worked in the emergency room of a hospital when orderlies were able to do a lot of things back in the 60s and watching death, working in a nursing home and watching death, I think it is one of those things that if you decide to get involved with this arena, you got to ask yourself this one really important question. Can you involve yourself and then disengage when you walk out? If you cannot disengage, I will guarantee you, within 6 months to 2 years, you will not be doing this. And that's part of the stuff that we do when we interview. We now ask those questions. It's part of the stuff that we follow up with our DVM team. How are you handling, are you being able to disengage? We have had two people who, if they had not left, I would have let them go, not because they weren't doing good work, but because they could not disengage. And that's a question you have to ask yourself. As Angela said, we get intimately involved in these people's lives in this hour to hour and a half, from 40 minutes to an hour. And it's incredible what happens in them. But if you can't disengage, if you can't walk away knowing that you've done the very best you can, you've done the very best you can for the pet and the people, pet parents, then this is not a job for you. And so we try to make that really clear. Because that's an incredibly important question. Because it's something that we have to ask ourselves.
I mean, I know I'm not one of the vets, but, you know, I've been with the company 6 years, so I've seen a lot of things. But the other thing is, you know, each person has to have an avenue for self-care. There's got to be things that you have to do for you that you get rejuvenated through. And I think, you know, Angel said it too, is it's we have a team dynamic. You know, we're not just an organization that has a bunch of employees. We look at our organization as a team, and we can lean on each other and call each other. We have our grief support specialist, which helps when, you know, people are in that struggle, like I think I'm heading towards burnout, and, you know, we just kind of help them, guide them along. Because even in the office, even though I don't take appointments, I have to tell you, there's times where I'm like, I'm done taking calls. Like, I can't take another hysterical person on the phone. But you know, Larry nailed it. I mean, you do have to also be able to disengage, and when you leave work.
So, yeah, that is a key life skill, as Larry has indicated, that ability to separate and disengage, and recognizing either that you can't, that that's not in you, that's not part of who you are. That recognition is very, very important. Or as you're going along, if you're starting to recognize, I'm not separating, I'm not disengaging, and knowing that you need some. But we, as a company, are very, very careful and deliberate about how we schedule our veterinarians. We are careful and deliberate about the growth of the company, too, in that regard, knowing that having veterinarians is the absolute way that we're going to get this done. So we recognize compassion fatigue. We recognize just plain fatigue. It doesn't have to be compassion fatigue. We're just tired. At this point, you know, we've learned a lot about what we need to do to keep everybody as healthy as they can be and recognize when they need that kind of help.
I want to add one other thing to that, Monty. As the team has talked about this, this really is. It is a business, but this is the most fantastic team that I've ever been able to be a part of. Part of it is and I'd like to get into the business side of this if you want to. It's a strategic, intentional plan to build teams. Teams don't just occur. There are things you have to do to create team dynamics. And so it's a dynamic process all the time, and I love your question. Yes?
What fraction of your appointments would you say are hospice care and kind of planned euthanasias as opposed to kind of immediate, this needs to happen, kind of?
That's a great question. Part of where we are in this dynamic of building a relationship is that the veterinary profession has not, we as a profession, have not been able to address well that question. Because, as I said, our society is an anti-death, or don't talk about death society. As I was growing up in the 40s and 50s before the polio vaccine and all the things that have happened, death was very common in families. And so people understood death as something that happened, and it was a fairly normal thing. You go through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and now most of society does not want to talk about death. And so, as Kim said, our calls, the calls that come into our center are almost all crisis calls because people have not been able to deal with, well, I got to think about this. In fact, we have clients who call, and we've got a full schedule, and so it's maybe it's 9 o'clock in the morning. They schedule for an appointment at 5 o'clock because we can't get them in anymore. The pet dies before we get there. That's how close this venue is a lot of times. Now, we were talking coming up, and after almost 9 years, actually May, middle of this month, we're now getting people who are beginning to make appointments at least 1 or 2 days in advance. And that's because Kim and the client relations team continues to target that, to discuss this with them. But it's still a crisis situation. On days that we're full, and that's why we need 2 more veterinarians, on days we are full, we have people who will call and cancel just because we can't get there soon. And it's not that they don't want to, but they call that morning, expect us to be there that afternoon because they haven't thought through where they are with this path. And that's a solution we still haven't figured out. That's a great question.
For when I was hired, I know that we had mentioned, is it 94% of calls or appointments are in-home euthanasia? Maybe 4% was hospice or consults?
Right.
Is there any changes to that?
No, there actually is not. That has been consistent over the last 9 years, that our hospice or consults run at about 3 to 4%. And to give you a frame of reference, we've got, 4 days a week, right? And currently there are 5 doctors out on the road for almost all of the day. You know, we use a staggered schedule. We don't have to get into all of that. But for the vast majority of the day, there are 5 doctors out on the road. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are a little bit slower. So right now we have 4 doctors out on the road on those days. We have pulled back because we've lost some doctors recently due to some health issues. So we would like to get to a point where we have consistently 5 or 6 doctors out on the road, just to give you an idea of how busy it can be. And that, you know, right now we're in the neighborhood of about 540 appointments per month for the team, 545 per month, a month for the whole team. So that's 10 doctors running appointments. But yeah, still staying consistently at 3
3% is consult and hospice or palliative.
We might have more that start as a consult, like they want someone to come out, just because they need that vet to say, yes, it's okay to say goodbye. I would say a lot of them that are like that. Some they're like, no, I just want a consult. But
I know in school I was always taught never tell the client that it's time. Even when I was in the hospice program, I heard that a lot. I don't tell them that it's time necessarily, but I listen to what they're saying every day. They live with the animal every single day. They're getting up in the middle of the night. They're not sleeping in their own beds anymore. I've actually had a client whose mom broke her back helping the dog out, fractured her back. And so we talk a lot about that stuff, about what they can do to help the dog, what they can't do. I lost my train of thought.
It's catching.
It happens.
Oh, we were talking about. Oh, yeah.
Oh, talking about this type of there. I've had where it's straight up the euthanasia, and they're like, actually, he's like standing up and wagging his tail now, and I hear that the most.
Oh, yeah.
So commonly. They're greeting me at the door.
They're eating.
And so we sit down, like, but what did you notice yesterday? Oh, the dog was completely flat on the floor. We're not eating anymore. We eat all the time. Turning away from bacon, which is like delicious, stuff like that. And usually you help with the conversation where they actually do lead back to you this time. Mm-hmm. What I have said a lot of times during or afterwards is, you know, I think you picked as perfect a time as it can be. You weren't too early and you weren't too late. I think there's the medical part for the dog. There is also maybe a social or psychological part that we're not so familiar with. I had a dog who loved people. She had hemangiosarcoma. I think she would have lived forever, and I had to make that call. I still feel bad because I still miss her. That's what a lot of people go through.
Oops, I'm sorry. Look back on the back. She was first.
Well, you kind of asked my exact question, but to expand on that, in being in such high demand as you are, and as you are, I was wondering what your scheduling is like in terms of how much time you allot to your appointment to be able to give the clients the time and space they need, also accounting for the travel time in between appointments.
We used to allot 2 hours, and then what was it, a year ago?
Two years ago.
Discussed it at one of our team meetings, and we decided to go to 2.5 hours to allow for, number one, for travel time, and for us to have that time. And then there's paperwork and all this stuff. We do body care. I mean, there's a whole number of dynamics in that. And I think that 2.5 hours has been really helpful to the team.
A 2.5 hour block, then some of that becomes your travel time. The average amount of time that we spend in the home is an hour. That's pretty consistent. Some are less, some are more, but the average is an hour, and that is still including giving them the time that they want and need. After the pet has passed, we step out, and we always tell them there's no hurry. And for the most part, the vast majority of people are pretty timely at that point. You know, I think it's really unusual to be waiting and waiting and wondering what is going on inside and be feeling like, oh gosh, I'm going to have to go in and say something. It really doesn't happen very often. Now, probably people spend about 10 or 20, maybe 20 minutes at the most with their pet after they have passed. Then the rest of that 2.5 hours gives us the travel time and time just to do our paperwork. Our body care.
Drink water and eat food.
Yes, go to the bathroom.
Can't believe you in the bathroom.
I know, it's wild. But so the 2.5 hours has been working out great. A lot of our doctors are very efficiently using that time, and that cuts down on all those aftercare tasks that they have to do at the end of the day. If they can get those done as they're going along, they've got time to relax, sleep.
I think my first 3 or 4 months, part of why I was going through burnout was I felt like I was really slow. And that's like getting them in the bag, trying to do it as gently as you can. getting a paw print if you can in between appointments, because once it's in the bag, if you need to bring them out, it's more complicated. And then hiding the bodies in a very nice way so that no one notices that there's something there that can be a body. Getting paperwork done, I would come home and be really, really tired, and then have to do everything at like 6 or 5 a.m. in the morning sometimes. But it's gotten to the point where I can do body care really fast. I've gotten a lot of paw prints done really nicely. Before this, I had 6 paw prints one night, and by 12 a.m., I didn't do any of them yet because I was primary, so that means that I'm like on basically 24/7. It was bad. But now I'm getting them done where I had 6 recently, and I actually didn't have to get up too early in the morning, so I'm very happy. So timing-wise, I think it's pretty good. If you're going to be late, I mean, there is traffic. You can't help it. Sometimes people live really far away, and their address doesn't actually show up. That's happened occasionally. But the client relations team are really, really good about looking out for that stuff. I went to the mountains one day. I was freaked out because there was some snow, and the snow was like really, really high on the sides of the road. There were cars that were trying to move the snow away. Finally get to this location, the GPS says, you're here. I'm like, where am I? The guy goes, you have to go straight around the mountain. Da, da, da. I went, I couldn't see a house. I almost got stuck twice. Finally, I called him, and luckily I had signal. And he starts driving me to this weird place. It's like a cliff. There's construction stuff there. I'm kind of worried. So I was going to back up and go away. But then I see this like this underground house, and it was actually really beautiful. He had a 120-pound dog, Mastiff. He couldn't move the dog himself. He did it last time with one other person, and it was bad. And so the CRTs, we always see CRT team on accident, that same team twice. But they gave me extra time. I tried to call in as much as I could because I was so scared I wouldn't have reception.
What people want is just communication.
Like most of the people that call you have already made a decision about euthanasia, or maybe that decision has been made for them by circumstances already. But I just wondered if you ever find that you go into a situation where you think maybe euthanasia isn't indicated at that particular moment, or maybe an appointment that was scheduled as euthanasia becomes a hospice circumstance where you're kind of working with them.
That does happen, but I think that probably 98 or 99% of our clients that call for euthanasia, they are spot on in their assessment of their animal. Yeah. And of course, we start assessing the minute we walk in the door. Because we do see a lot of pets who the owners have called for euthanasia. It's not a consult. It's not a consult with possible euthanasia. It's a euthanasia. And the dog is wagging its tail, has greeted us at the door. And we just take our time to watch and listen. You know, those dogs are just simply trying to do their job. That's their job, to get up and greet a guest. And as we watch them, we realize that they are exhausted. And that was all they could muster, was to get up and come to the door, wipe their tail, and they are wiped out. But that listening and observing is key. But the reality is that the vast majority of people are correct in their assessment of their animal. Those that there is that question, you know, still for us on our end, is this the right thing? It's, you know, we start talking carefully now and using that quality of life scale, talking about pain, ease of breathing, mobility, nutrition, hydration, and very, very importantly, happiness and good days versus bad days. So you just bring that tool out over and over again. Whether it's just in our heads, we're ticking through those criteria, or we are verbally going through with the owner. You may be getting at convenience euthanasia. And so we actually really don't see that in our practice, probably because of the pricing. You know, there are other options for people who are bent on a convenience euthanasia. They have many other options that are a lot less expensive.
And our team in the client relations team helps
yes.
a lot in trying to determine what's going on. It sounds like that. We've had kind of back to what we, I think what Lori was talking about earlier too. I feel like I see more that I have to reassure them that they are making the right decision. So I go through the, I ask them, do you want me to go into the process of the disease? Do you understand it? Some people are like, no, I don't want to learn anything. And then others are like, yeah, please. And they're like very, very attentive. And they want me to draw pictures for them. And then that helps them a lot. The client relations team, they let them know too, because I've picked up the phone before too. And there's people like, but you know, I just don't know. Are you guys just gonna come and then euthanize my dog? I'm like, no. Or Kim's like, no. They'll come in, get to know your dog, get to know where you are, and then well, you guys will proceed accordingly. If there's anything that we can do, the doctor will let you know.
And we're continuing to learn. This is a process where we have a dynamic, a great team, a lot of sharing. We have a team meeting once a month where everybody comes to a location so we can dialogue about this. Because it's really important that we keep these things in front of us all the time. We're asking ourselves questions all the time. Yes, ma'am.
So think about the student debt crisis that is happening and how physically and emotionally demanding this job is. How do you think that it's been, I guess this is a more targeted question, but coming out of that school, having a competitive salary but still taking care of yourself too, can you elaborate on some of that?
I was really scared starting this job because it's production based. And so I know like in our business school or class, they taught us how to negotiate and all that and how you need pro sal and all that. But all the vets were reassuring me that you don't have to worry. There's no competition here with other vets. We really are a team. I think that's sober. So it's not that like, I'm gonna take your appointment, yours, yours, yours. It's all gonna be mine because I need the money. And so I went off with, I started thinking, just relax and kind of go with the flow for a month or two and see what happens. And we have so many appointments. I actually, I can say, hey, you don't work very much. Did you want this one? Or sometimes people ask and they're very polite about it. And it's okay to say no. Where right now I'm not worried financially. The first few months, it was a bit of a struggle because it is a really high debt. But I've been talking to Dr. Carey a lot. And there's two team leads, Lori and Carey. And so she's talked to me about stuff like that. If I needed help, I reach out. Self-care-wise, I wasn't so good initially. I think it's really good that CSU talks about self-care a lot. Try to take that more seriously. And then Mandy Browning, we've kind of mentioned her. She's a grief support specialist. She sometimes attends our meetings and she'll say, you know, this is my assignment to you. What are you grateful for or something? And you email her. We're also welcome to talk to her. I have my own therapist. That's really beneficial. And then now that I feel like my performance is more squared away with like body care and all that, the day to day, I have more time for myself for sure. Does that help?
One of the things that would add to that, and that's for the executive team, which Roger's a part of that, he's not here today. We chose quite a number of years ago to require that anybody that comes on our team be in the profession practicing for at least 3 to 5 years. Because there's so many things you can learn from that period. Whether you're here at Caring Pathways or whether you're in a busy practice, I will guarantee you it's going to create stress for you when you graduate. Because it's a whole different dynamic. Now, some practices are really good about that understanding, some practices aren't. And if you get in one that isn't, you're in for a tough ride. But because I've been through all that, I could tell you story. Story after story of the 52 years I've been a veterinarian. My heart is for that not to be a part of who we are. Now, sometimes the dynamic of the number of veterinarians we have just how long ago, we went to a 12-hour shift because we got enough veterinarians so we could start doing that. And that's part of the problem of starting a business. When I first started this business, I was 68 years old, and I was doing 24/7 every day of the week for almost a year. And then for quite a while long after that, most of the days still online. And then Lori came on 5 years ago, and we've been able to add to the team, so now I'm not teaching appointments. But that's part of the dynamic of if you want to build a business. As I said, this is my 50th, in June, I'll be starting my 53rd year of being a veterinarian. I love challenges. I just love the opportunity to do things that someone says you can't do.
I was worried initially about production, by the way. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just thought about that. Like, do I feel pressured to sell more things? Because if we have, for body care, there's three options. There's communal, where they don't get the ashes back. And then there's either separated or private. Private is, it's just them in the crematory. And then separated, the crematory is pretty big. They have more than one dog or cat, but they're spaced apart at an adequate distance. The difference there is $100. So that's a good amount of money for me. I've never, ever felt like I should push for the private. I don't really try to convince them one or the other, but I have always said, hey, you want private? Did you want me to go over the difference? Because I've always gone with separated myself. I think that's pretty important, and I don't feel like I'm not earning enough money to be happy.
Yeah, our doctors are very well compensated.
Yes.
Better, seemingly better than you can do in associate and traditional practice. And I was an associate in traditional practice, and now I practiced out in Ohio. And I kind of, as an associate, the best I could probably do out there back in the early 2000s was about $60,000 a year. And working for Larry it's incredible how well compensated all of us are, our full-time doctors. It's very rewarding in that regard.
Part of that is a cultural thing that has to do with me. It has to do with the reward for doing. If you don't do a great job, and I know this is always stressful, whether it's Angel or anybody coming on, but I've done all the statistics, I've done all the studies, I've been around a long time. I want people to be so integrated to the culture of who we are that they're comfortable communicating with us and directing, not directing, giving them the option that's best for them. So it's not what you charge necessarily, it's what you give in service. If you serve these people in the heart and you allow them to be a part of who you are, you will always do well. And I'm a walking testimony of that. And I believe that from the very depths of my heart. And you can ask this group if that's true.
Absolutely, it's true.
We offer a discount for like veterans.
Yes.
It doesn't come out of my paycheck. Comes out from him.
That's very considerate.
Because I value
him. So overall, what's the most rewarding part of your job?
Overall, what's the most rewarding part?
There's so many rewarding things. I've never gotten so many compliments or positive stuff. And sometimes it's not about me, just about the company. Where we made such a significant impact. I love when I go into a family situation and there's kids involved. And it's these twins, and this little girl goes, "So, Daddy, you know how we talked about the die shot? And, like, you're going to go upstairs with me." And I'm like, "Okay." She's like, "I think Mommy needs you more. So you need to stay with her. She's 10 years old." Ugh. And then I have one I'll show you guys later at the end. But it was basically where I didn't know what the dad of the family was thinking. He seemed really stern, cried a little bit. I wasn't sure if he was like happy or sad with us. And then it was a really good video. But I'll show you that later.
Yeah, it's the gratitude. The gratitude is incredible. Not like anything I've experienced before. Like Angel said, it's not about us. It's about relieving that pad. You know, people greet us at the door with open arms. They will hug us before we have even said hello, because we are there to relieve them. Yeah, it's the gratitude is amazing. I got kisses yesterday from two different clients, older women. I had their pet who had passed. I was leaving, had their pet in my arms, so we couldn't hug. There's a lot of hugging that goes on. So these ladies, so that's, you know, it's, I don't know if I even have the words for the gratitude.
Yeah, it's amazing. The cards that we send to the vets, the calls that we get in the office, the emails that we get on a daily, weekly basis of just, Angel was an angel. I hear that all the time. We agree. But, you know, it's so amazing to know that we were able to help this family and this pet at such a difficult time, and we made it a good experience in such a horrible situation. And we hear that daily. So. And constantly vet clinics. Thank you so much. You guys are so awesome. We're so thankful you're able to do this. I mean, it's daily. It's an honor. Like, people go, how do you do that? I'm like, it's an honor and a blessing that, yeah, I only take the calls. I'm not the one out there getting the personal hugs, but I walk these people through what's going to happen and then send the vet out to help them. And it's just, you walk away from your day going, I helped some people today and they were so happy about it. Like, they were sad, but they were happy because, you know, I mean, it is. And some grab your heart.
I've had a lot of tough clients where you walk in and it feels very negative. Like, what do I do? What do I say? Should I talk minimally? And then by the end of it, they're so happy, actually. They actually say, wow, I never knew that this could look so well. It was very peaceful. Even when I was stressed out during the process, because the vein is a little bit hard to get, because there is no vein. They still end up saying thank you most of the time. And I don't need a thank you, but saying that they can see, saying goodbye can be positive is pretty cool. There was one client who was like, yeah, I thought you guys were just going to come and euthanize a pet and go. That was exactly how she said it. But then Jamie picked up the phone, and that's one of our CRTs, and she was so kind. She was so kind. And she talked her through the process where she's like, oh, you're not just going to come and she's like, no. And then she was happy. Like, she was very happy in the end, considering this is the dog she's had for 18 years.
I think, too, sometimes, you know, you take a call or you're at an appointment, you have to remember they're grieving. And, you know, everybody deals with their grief differently. I mean, I get people on the phone, I get off the phone, I'm like, God, a jerk, oh, my gosh. Why? I'm trying to help. You're being, you know, and then Lori will go out and be like, oh, yeah, he was so thankful, said you guys were nice, you know, he was the nicest guy, and you're just like, grief. Okay. You know? But it does. You just have to remember people deal with grief. And it's the gamut. I mean, I've had people laugh on the phone with me. Tawny had someone the other day. She talked to this guy twice, and both times he must have forgot he called us because he was like, that's too expensive. He's like, oh, but I got a joke for you. Like, his dog's dying, but he's going to tell us a joke. It's pretty funny.
Just a moment. We're about to run out of time. We're willing to stay longer if you want, because I like the questions, but it's totally up to you.
On the more business side, I worked as a receptionist before this, and it was always difficult navigating the cost and the billing. And we had already built that relationship with the client for years, and so usually it was built later. But how is that for you guys, dealing with that conversation? Because it does sound like it's a high cost, and since you don't have a prior relationship with them a lot of times.
So they know before we even go out what those costs are going to be. We won't ever send a vet out without going over all of our costs. Mm-hmm. And then we also go over and letting them know, you know, their options for payment and that the payment is due at that time. So before the vet even arrives, they have the expectations already set.
Okay. There's kind of a strategic way of going about employment where the way that the form works out, you have initial that this is what they want, that they give permission to do this, the dog hasn't been in the last 10 days, and then the price is there. And then I'm like, and the total is this. usually that's all I have to say, and then they'll pay. Once in a while, you do get the, oh yeah, it's so expensive, but then they'll still pay. Then there are times where it's more emergent. I'm like, you know, I'm going to wait on the payment. We're going to do this first because your dog's breathing really, really heavy. It's not doing good. So I haven't really had a problem with that. I think the people who answer the phone, they work with that a lot. And then most people are like, you know, I hate this part. Like, in a clinic, sometimes they'll bill you. But then we just met. I just want to get this part out of the way. And then it's, like, really, really nice. So I haven't had a problem with it.
Strategically, the fees are very, they're not exorbitant. When I went to Denver and began to do this, I do studies on fees. And we're giving a service that they don't get at the veterinary hospital. We're giving a service where they don't get from Dunfrancy. We're doing a service that really satisfies the heart. You know, we keep track of a lot of statistics. Right now, and Kim was just sharing as we were coming up, because this is a cold, cold crisis situation with people who, unless they've used this before, which we have a fair number of those, they're just calling us either as a recommendation from the veterinarian or from the social media stuff that Josh is doing. So they're new to this. Yes,
just a quick one. Do you think that you'll ever expand to different states? Have you already? And would you ever expand to large animal as well? Or small animal exotics, like a guinea pig or a rabbit? You know, do you guys just do cat, dog? Like, how's that? Do you see that going?
We do. When I first started, I had a veterinarian who actually worked with me at New Hills down in Denver. And she was into rabbits and different. But the problem with that is you have, number one, you don't see them. And number two, you have to build a protocol for sedation, euthanasia, and because those are a real small part of what we do, we elect to go just with dog and cats. Now, does that say that at some point in time somebody may come and do that? Absolutely not. And if they did, if we had a call, we would refer them to it. I practiced here in dog comments. I have no problems anymore. It's part of life. And that's a good question, because we were doing something, but we found that our sedation protocols and the things that we needed, and just the ability to handle the animals. A lot of people are not trained to do that. We're already having enough problems finding better areas without adding all of these things to it. That's a great question. So why don't you do it?
Okay. I wanted to say one quick thing that. Something that's common to many of our doctors is that they come from a place of not being sure before they came to us, not being sure what part of veterinary medicine they should be involved in, how they should be practicing, not finding the satisfaction that when they were in school they hoped they would have in traditional practice. That is a common theme with our doctors. And so I just wanted to let you guys know that that is okay. If you are not sure what part of veterinary medicine you should be in, I was there myself. I have explored many things. I started out as a large animal vet. I have, you know, at times looked into, not recently, I looked into military, regulatory medicine, all kinds of things. Specializing maybe in traditional practice, maybe that would give me that feeling satisfaction that I was looking for. But I have found my home here in Caring Pathways, and all of our doctors at this point would say the same thing. So I just want to let you guys know that if you are feeling that way, whether it's today or 5 years from now or 10 years from now, give me a call and we'll talk about it. We'll talk about how it's okay to feel that way and help you explore where your home is in veterinary medicine.
Thank you.
also created a website just for you. It's called joincaringpathways.com. And it's all about targeting and communicating the Caring Pathways story and the Caring Pathways opportunity to better areas. And so if you have some interest, you can go to joincaringpathways.com. And that's where you'll find out more about joining the team and then also plans for expansion. Yeah.